ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Ukraine to receive $95 million worth of military aid from Australia. Also, a Queensland inquiry into the CFMEU, his more allegations of intimidation and bullying. And celebrating the life of the legendary Northern Territory folk musician and land rights campaigner, Ted Egan, who's died at 93.
He loves Australia so much, and he loves the history of Australia so much, and the characters and the people. You can taste the pictures, you can see them. He captures Australia so beautifully.
First this evening, the Australian government has announced a new package of military support for Ukraine, totalling $95 million. It comes as the United States continues to hold talks on a possible peace deal with both Russia and Ukraine. But the US President Donald Trump doesn't appear confident an agreement can be reached, saying the path ahead for the talks remains unclear. And speaking of the United States, there's a development today on the AUKUS security deal between the US, Australia and the UK. For more on both developments, I spoke to the ABC's defence and national security correspondent, Olivia Casely. Olivia, what does this new support package for Ukraine include?
Well, it's a really significant one, $95 million, and it includes $50 million for what's known as the Priority Ukraine Requirement List, or PEARL, which is basically a 17-nation funding mechanism that pulls money to buy important weapons for Kyiv. So that can include things such as ammunition, long-range missiles and artillery to try and help the Ukrainians repel the invading Russian forces. So as well in that, we've heard about tactical air defence radars, munitions and combat engineering equipment. So in the background of all of this, Australia is also in talks about actually sending over some helicopters that we're retiring. They're called Tiger helicopters. That's something Ukraine is really keen for. So that's an announcement we could hear even in the next couple of days. But what's significant about this fresh round of support in general is that it's the first announcement we've had in about a year, and it takes the total aid provided to Ukraine by Australia since the start of the conflict, I should say, to $1.7 billion. And when it comes to that PEARL thing I mentioned earlier, we are actually one of the first non-NATO nations to contribute to that pooling mechanism to help fund those weapons.
And Olivia, the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, has also confirmed today that the government has received that report of the United States review of the AUKUS agreement. Has he revealed anything, though, about its findings?
Well, look, that's the million-dollar question at this stage, but we do know it's in the government's hot little hands and landed in just the past couple of days. So just to remind listeners, this review was spearheaded by senior US official and one-time AUKUS skeptic Elbridge Colby. And there had been speculation earlier this year that it would result in some pretty major changes to the way that the $368 billion pact operates. I've got to say, though, those fears were quelled somewhat in October when US President Donald Trump met with Anthony Albanese face-to-face for the first time, when Mr. Trump really indicated that the pact was moving full steam ahead, and he did appear to give it a ringing endorsement. Mr. Marles this morning was certainly sounding confident about the future of the AUKUS pact.
What's really important here is the United States is completely supportive of AUKUS, as the President of the United States made clear, and all of us are moving ahead, in his words, full steam, with full steam. And so this is a program that we are doing, meeting all of our milestones. It's fundamentally important in terms of Australia's national interest, but this really is very central to the United States' national interest as well.
That's Richard Marles, the Defence Minister and Acting Prime Minister at the moment. So, Olivia, even if this US review of AUKUS comes back and says, yes, we're okay with it, full steam ahead, are there still questions about how the AUKUS project is going to proceed?
Yeah, I think ultimately it is an enormous undertaking, and it's fair to say there are concerns on all sides. So that's the United Kingdom, Australian and United States as well, about each of those countries' own abilities to really boost their own industrial base in order to support the building of AUKUS submarines. So Australia, for example, is due to get its first Virginia-class submarines from the United States in 2027, so not really that far into the future. So, for example, we'll be looking at this AUKUS review pretty closely to, I guess, see more detail about the reality of that timeline and delivery when the review is finally released by Washington. But there's certainly a confidence among each of the partners and a real desire to get this pact underway and progressing full steam ahead. We are hoping that this review drops before Defence Minister Richard Marles, Foreign Minister Penny Wong head to Washington next week. They're actually going to be heading there for crucial Osman talks with their counterparts Pete Hegseth and Marco Rubio, where they'll no doubt pore over the finer details of this review.
Olivia Casely is the ABC's Defence and National Security Correspondent. Now to the Queensland inquiry into the alleged misconduct of the construction union, the CFMEU. The Queensland boss of its rival, the Australian Workers' Union, has broken down in tears while giving evidence about alleged harassment and intimidation she says she and her union officials have suffered at the hands of CFMEU officials. The inquiry has heard the CFMEU conducted a violent campaign against the AWU to gain dominance in the Queensland construction industry. Rachel Mealy reports.
Stacey Chanel says Labor Day is the most important day of the year in the union movement and is often referred to as Union Christmas. Every year, the Australian Workers' Union State Secretary takes her children to a rally and lunch, which is held at Brisbane's showgrounds. She says at the event in 2023, she was approached by a man in a CFMEU T-shirt whose face was painted with the words, "Australia's Worst Union," which was a common way of mocking her union's initials, AWU. She says he pointed to his forehead and asked her what she thought.
And I said, "All right, mate, you know, what do you want me to say? Just jog on." I wanted him to go. I was immediately alert that my child was sitting there and I didn't want him to have to witness this.
She says he continued to goad her into an argument, but she tried to direct him away from her family.
He then really pushed up against me and he leaned past me and it felt like he was trying to get past me into my child. And he said, "How does it feel to know your mum's a f***ing grub who sells out workers?"
Stacey Chanel alleges the former CFMEU State Secretary Jade Ingham was nearby and watched the incident play out.
But Mr. Ingham made no attempt to pull him away. He just watched it happen.
She told the inquiry a campaign of intimidation and violence by the CFMEU in Queensland has seen other officials in her union verbally and physically assaulted, and she suspects the CFMEU's former leaders know where she lives.
I don't know where Mr. Ingham lives. I don't know where Mr. Ravbar lives, but I'm reasonably confident that they know where I live. And I can't explain to you, particularly as a parent and a dog mum, how vulnerable that makes me feel.
She says other AWU officials have moved house as a result of the intimidatory tactics.
I know that people within those ranks know where some of my officials live. I've had people feel that the risk is so great they've had to move homes. I haven't done so. I would never let them win like that over me. I'm a homeowner as opposed to a renter. And I know that the impact of me sitting here today probably makes me a bigger target.
Stacey Chanel says the tactics the CFMEU have employed have cast a shadow over unions more generally.
What pains me so much is the damage that this has caused to the entire union movement. You know, the average union member in Australia is a woman in her 40s working in a care industry. She kind of looks like me. And what this has done has, I guess, really shifted the public narrative and perception of what unions are and what unions do. I think workers have been forgotten in this. I think political agendas have taken over, industrial agendas have taken over, and what we have seen from the conduct of some in the CFMEU is the absolute antithesis of unionism. It's the opposite of solidarity.
Stacey Chanel is the Queensland branch secretary of the Australian Workers' Union. Rachel Mealy reporting from Brisbane. The Victorian government is set to axe more than 1,000 public service jobs in an attempt to bring the state's soaring debt under control. An independent review has recommended about a third of the cuts target executive roles. The Premier, Jacinta Allen, says she supports any budget measure that'll ensure Victorians have more emergency service workers and teachers. Kathleen O'Connor has more.
Victoria's opposition is calling it a Christmas Grinch move. Liberal leader Jess Wilson attacking the government cuts during question time.
The government sat on the Silver Review for 5 months. Why has the government waited until just before Christmas to sack 1,000 Victorians?
Victorian Premier Jacinta Allen announced the government's plan to slash more than 1,000 public service jobs in the hope of saving $4 billion over the next 4 years. It follows the release of a report by top bureaucrat Helen Silver, who was tasked with coming up with ways to stream the public service.
We are looking at ways to keep our Victorian public service laser focused on delivering those frontline services that matter most to Victorian families and working people. Good education, good health care, keeping the community safe, and investing in real and meaningful cost of living measures.
Treasurer Jacqueline Symes had already predicted 2,000 to 3,000 jobs may be lost when she commissioned the review in February.
Today is all about ensuring that we are set up for the future, ensuring that every dollar that the government is spending on our public service is focused exactly where Victorians need it to be.
All of this comes after years of pressure on Victoria's Labor government over what critics viewed as overspending and spiralling state debt. Cuts to public service jobs were just one of many recommendations, the Premier defending her decision in Parliament.
Speaker, let's say for argument's sake, you had an $11.1 billion black hole hanging over your policy decisions. That would see 4,500 police officers, 9,000 teachers. Just to repeat, we will not cut those frontline workers, the teachers, the nurses, the healthcare workers, the police officers.
330 senior executive and technical specialist roles will be axed, saving the government $359 million. Reducing spending on consultants is predicted to save another $113 million. On the steps of Parliament, community and public sector union members protested against the cuts, led by its secretary, Giselle Hanna.
We've been seeing a decimation of the public service every year for the last 4 years, has resulted in untenable workloads for the remaining public servants. There are ways to realise budgetary savings that don't include job cuts.
Dr. David Haywood is an Emeritus Professor of Public Policy and Social Economy at RMIT University. He says Treasurer Jacqueline Symes made a smart move by ordering the review after she was presented with a difficult set of financials by former Treasurer Tim Pallas.
I think it's best understood as a political imperative arising from the delicate state of the state finances. So they wanted to have a political fix. And what this Silver Review has done is to say, well, look, you're doing okay at the moment. Now you can do it better by shedding 2,000 jobs and doing other things. The government's responded by going, okay, we'll do half of what you say and we'll get rid of a whole lot of fat cats. The budget will be fixed. And in the same breath, they'll be able to lay a trap for the opposition.
Professor Haywood says it's unclear exactly what jobs will end up on the chopping block. And he argues Victoria's financial position is not as bad as people think.
I'm one of those ones who doesn't see it as being as bad as a lot of other people. We've got about $195 billion of debt, but there's about $440 billion of assets. So when you look at that equation, that's actually pretty good. I think the problem they've got is that the budget budget surplus is razor-thin. They're a little bit behind schedule and they need to make it bigger just in case there is another recession.
Victoria's opposition leader Jess Wilson disagrees.
Well, this is a government that has lost control of the finances. And what this report shows today is not only the fact that we have a bloated public service, a public service that is not delivering the essential services that Victorians need, but more importantly, that this mismanagement is a scathing report on the Victorian economy as a whole.
Victoria's Liberal opposition leader Jess Wilson, Kathleen O'Connor with that report. This is PM, I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Queensland researchers believe they're getting closer to understanding the cause of what's known as Gulf War illness. About 1,800 Australians served in the conflict led by the US against Iraq in the early 1990s. The researchers say about a third of veterans experienced symptoms like chronic fatigue, brain fog and disturbed sleep, but the illness isn't recognised by the Australian government. And the researchers are hoping their latest breakthrough could help find a cure for the condition. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
Ian Allwood was only 19 years old when he left Australia to serve in the Gulf War, but it's what happened when he came home that researchers are analysing.
Most of my colleagues and friends that I have dealt with over the years complain of chronic fatigue, pain and swelling and things like brain fog and definitely the sleep disturbances is very, very common.
The Gulf War began in 1990 when Iraqi President Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and Western nations sent their militaries in to drive him back. And for many, it's had an ongoing impact. Mr. Allwood, who's now a sergeant with New South Wales Police, says he was left without a label for his symptoms.
If you're a veteran, and especially as a male, it's hard to say to people that you feel unwell or you're not right. And then when you go to a doctor and you're unable to explain why that is the case, it's no disparaging of our current medical system, but certainly they weren't aware and we weren't aware that unique things had happened to us.
But that all changed when sufferers were approached by researchers at Griffith University.
Professor Gradznik and Dr. Finch came up with a way to test ourselves, and they came up with some significant changes in our genes that are certainly unique to our cohort, which really, really validates us because we were going to doctors and they were unable to diagnose what was going on with the Gulf War illness groups.
Dr. Natalie Eaton-Fitch is a research fellow at the National Centre for Neuroimmunology and Emerging Diseases at Griffith University.
So we do know from association studies that there is very much a link between these exposures and what happens, that the symptom presentation, what we find in a laboratory to suggest that there's a very strong link between these toxic exposures leading to long-term changes within these people.
Despite decades of research, the actual cause of Gulf War illness is still unknown. So now researchers can take a closer look at the gene changes in veterans with symptoms.
We wanted to determine from these gene changes what immune markers are of importance for us, and we identified 33 significant gene changes that are associated with Gulf War illness.
Bringing hope and the possibility of closure to veterans all over the world.
Veterans with GWI have struggled for decades without clear, specific answers. And each bit of research provides a potential path forward for veterans suffering from this terrible condition.
It couldn't come a second too soon for Ian Allwood.
I think I was one of the youngest blokes to go to the Gulf. I'm now almost 55, so many of my colleagues are certainly older than me and are suffering in silence a lot. So it gives me confidence that at least there is someone who's able to identify these markers and moving forward, we should be able to find a treatment path.
He says the work being done by Griffith University is in itself validating for those suffering, but to have the illness recognised by the federal government would be a huge step in the right direction.
I'd like to think as a society we can care for those people as they get older and understand that there are things that have happened to them. It's not a fault of their own, just they're doing their jobs, serving their country, and they've come back and they've ended up with some things wrong with them.
That's Gulf War veteran Ian Allwood, Elizabeth Cramsey with that report. Northern Territory folk musician, author and political campaigner Ted Egan has died at the age of 93. Born in Melbourne, he moved to the Top End as a teenager and got involved in local sport and Indigenous rights. And he even ended up as the Queen's representative in the Territory. But it was his long career as a singer and songwriter that made him a household name there. Diana Damjanovic prepared this tribute.
Ride another mile and forget about the drover's boy.
He was a man of many talents, a gregarious character with 30 albums under his belt and 17 books. But it was his lyrics that touched the masses. Matt Scullion is an Australian singer-songwriter, a Golden Guitar winner and friend of Ted Egan.
He loves Australia so much. And he loves the history of Australia so much and the characters and the people. And I love the way that he paints a picture. Like when you read a good author and the book's full of metaphors and it's wonderful pictures and you can almost taste the pictures. That's what Ted's songs are like. You can taste the pictures, you can see them.
Born in 1932 in the Melbourne suburb of Coburg, Ted Egan began life during the Great Depression. And at 16, he moved to Darwin, searching for adventure.
For the tall white man and the slim black boy had never had much to say.
As a young man, he helped establish the St Mary's Football Club in Darwin in 1952 as a way to give Indigenous people from the Tiwi Islands a chance to play. Longtime friend Gibson Ilortimer Farmer is a former chairman of the Tiwi Islands Land Council and says he's sad to learn of his mate's death.
And then today he told me, I got shocked. I'm crying now. I got tears in my eye for him, you know. He's a trailblazer, you know.
He began recording music in 1969, debuting with his song, Drinkers of the Northern Territory.
Oh, they got some bloody good drinkers in the Northern Territory. From Darwin down to Alice Springs, we're always on a spree.
That same year, he wrote one of his most prolific and consequential songs, Gurindji Blues, also known as Poor Bugger Me, alongside land rights activist Vincent Lingiari. In a 2012 interview with the ABC, Ted Egan said it was one of his career highlights.
I became a very strong follower of Vincent Lingiari and their strike, which everyone had laughed about. Everyone said, oh, they'll be starved back into subjection in a couple of weeks. But they lasted until 75, and it was the longest strike in Australian history. And in their support, I wrote the song Gurindji Blues. And I am very proud of the fact that I wrote it. And I sang it for old Vincent about a month before he died. He said, sing my song for me again. And I was crying a bit, but I sang it for him.
At the time, Egan was working as a research officer at the Council of Aboriginal Affairs. After the song was released, Peter Nixon's department head insisted Egan be sacked for his role in writing the song. Egan was an outspoken critic of government policies for Indigenous people until the very end of his life. He served as the administrator of the Northern Territory, the NT's equivalent of a state governor, from November 2003 to October 2007.
It's an ongoing thrill and there's never a negative moment.
Egan was a prolific folk musician, using only an empty cardboard beer carton as a percussion instrument alongside his own voice. The beer pioneer said he started tapping beer cartons, or what he called the Foster phone, because he couldn't play any other instruments.
G'day, mate, well, what do you play? And you say, well, sort of swallow it, and you say, well, actually, I play a beer carton, and you can see the look on their face. They just glaze over, and you think, what am I? They're thinking, what am I doing here? But at the end of the day, invariably, they say, gee, it's a good sound.
Matt Scullion says he never lost his passion for life.
And he still had the biggest fire in his belly, and he had another album that he wanted to record. He still wrote a weekly newspaper article for the local Alice Springs newspaper. You know, he still had so much that he wanted to do, but I guess at the end of the day, his body let him down. It definitely wasn't his mind or his spirit or his soul. I guess his body just wore out and just couldn't go on anymore.
Australian singer-songwriter Matt Scullion. That report from Diana Damjanovic. Thanks very much for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app, and that's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning too. Today's episode is looking at how Australia's renewable energy transition is going. PM will be back at the same time tomorrow. I hope you have a very good night. We'll be right back.